Fergus MacDonald swore softly with both hands on the firing handles of the Vickers, his four fingers still holding the automatic safety catch open and his thumbs poised over the firing button. He kept the weapon swinging in short rhythmic traverses back and forth as he peered down the slope. But he was swearing, monotonous profanity in a low, tight whisper. The man beside him was kneeling, ready to feed the belt into the gun, and now he whispered hoarsely, "I think you got him."
"The hell I did,"
hissed Fergus, and jerked the gun across, as something in shadow caught his eye down on the road. He fired a short holding burst and then muttered,
"Right, let's pull out."
"Damn it, comrade, we've got them," protested the loader.
"You bloody fool, didn't you see him?" Fergus asked.
"Didn't you see the way he crossed the road? Don't you realise we've got a real ripe one on our hands? Whoever he is, he's a killer."
"Are we going to let one bastard chase us?"
"You're so right," snapped Fergus. "When it's that bucko down there, I'm not going to risk this gun. It's worth 100 trained men."
He patted the square steel breech block.
"We came here to kill Clever Yanni, and he's down there cooking in his fancy motor car. Now let's get the hell out of here."
And he started the complicated process of unloading the Vickers, cranking it once to clear the chamber of its live round, and then cranking again to clear the round in the feed block.
"Tell the boys to cover us when we pull back," he grunted,
as he extracted the ammunition belt from the breech pawls, and then started uncoupling the Vickers from its tripod.
"Come on, come on, work quickly," he snapped at his loader. "That bastard is on his way. I can feel him breathing down my neck already."
There were 8 strikers on the slope of the dump. Fergus and 2 for the Vickers, with 5 riflemen spread out around the gun to support and cover.
"Right, let's go."
Fergus carried the thick jacketed barrel over one shoulder and a heavy case of ammunition in his left hand. His number 2 wrestled with the ungainly 50 pounds weight of metal tripod, and the number 3 carried the 5-gallon can of cooling water and the second case of ammunition.
"We're pulling out," Fergus called to his rifleman. "Look lively, that's a dangerous bastard coming after us."
They ran in a group, bowed under their burdens, feet slipping in the loose white cyanided sand of the dump. The shot was from the left. Fergus had not expected that, and it was impossibly high on the dump. The bastard must have grown wings and flown to get there, Fergus thought. The report was a heavy, booming clap, some sort of sporting rifle, and behind him the number 3 made a strange grunting sound, as though his lungs had been forcibly emptied by a heavy blow. Fergus glanced back and saw him down, a dark, untidy shape on the white sand.
"Good Christ!" gasped Fergus. It had to be fluky shooting at that range, and in this impossible light, just the early stars and the ruddy glow of the burning Cadillac.
The rifle boom boomed again, and he heard one of his riflemen scream and then thrash about wildly in the undergrowth. Fergus knew he had judged his adversary fairly. He was a killer. They were all running now, shouting and firing wildly as they scattered back under the lee of the dump, and Fergus ran with them. Only one thought in his mind. He must get his precious Vickers safely away. The sweat had soaked through his jacket between his shoulders and had run down from under his cap so that he was blinded and unable to speak when at last he tumbled into the cover of a deep donga and sat against the earth of the bank with the machine gun cradled in his arms like an infant. One after another, his rifleman reached the donga and fell thankfully into cover.
"How many were there?" gasped one of them.
I don't know," panted another. "Must have been a dozen Zarps at least. They got Alfie, and they got Henry also. I saw 5 of them."
Fergus had recovered his breath enough to speak now.
"There was only one. Only one. But a good one."
"Did we get Slim Yanni?"
"Yes," said Fergus grimly. "We got him all right. He was in the first car. I saw his flag and I saw him cooking. We can go home now."
It was a little before 11 o'clock when the solitary Rolls-Royce was halted at the gates of police headquarters on Marshall Square by the suspicious sentries. But when the occupants were recognised, 6 high-ranking police and military officers hurried down the steps to welcome them. The Prime Minister went directly to the large visitors' drawing-room on the first floor, which had been transformed into the headquarters of the military administration, empowered and entrusted by the declaration of martial law with the government of the nation. The relief on the faces of the assembled officers was undisguised. The situation was a mess, but Smuts was here at last, and now they could expect order and direction and sanity to emerge from the chaos. He listened to their reports quietly, tugging at his little goatee beard, his expression becoming more grim as the full extent of the situation was explained. He was silent a little longer, brooding over the map, and then he looked up at General von Deventer, an old comrade in arms during two wars, a man who had ridden with him on that historic commando into the Cape in 1901, and who had fought beside him against the wily old German, Lettow von Vorbeck, in German East Africa. "Jacobus," he said, "you command the East Rand." Van Deventer whispered an acknowledgement, his vocal cords damaged by a British bullet in 01. "Sean, you have the West. I want the Brixton Ridge under our control by noon tomorrow." Then, as an afterthought, "Have your lads arrived from Natal yet?"
"I hope so," said Sean Courtney.
"So do I," Smuts smiled thinly. "You will have a merry time taking the ridge single-handed." The smile flickered off his face. "I want your battle plans presented by breakfast time, gentlemen. I don't have to remind you that, as always, the watchword is speed. We have to cauterize this ulcer and bind it up swiftly." In early autumn, the Highveld sun has a peculiar brilliance, pouring down through an atmosphere thinned by altitude out of a sky of purest, gayest blue. It was weather for picnicking and for lovers in quiet gardens. But on the 14th of March 1922 it was not calm, but a stillness of a menacing and ominous intensity which hung over the city of Johannesburg and its satellite towns. In just 2 days, Van Deventer had swept through the East Rand, stunning the strikers with his Boer commando tactics, rolling up all resistance in Benoni and Dunswart, recapturing Brakpan and the mine, while the Brits column, under his command, drove through the Modder and Geduld mines and linked with Van Deventer at Springs. In 2 days they had crushed the revolt on the East Rand, and thousands of strikers came in under the white flag to be marched away to captivity and eventual trial. But Fordsburg was the heart, and the Brixton Ridge, which commanded it, was the key to the revolt. Now, at last, Sean Courtney had the ridge. But it had been 2 days of hard and bitter fighting. With artillery and air support, they had swept the rocky kopjes, the school buildings, brick fields, the cemetery, the public buildings and the cottages, each of which the strikers had turned into a strong point. And in the night they had carried in the dead of both sides, buried them in the Milner Park Cemetery, each with his own comrades, soldier with soldier, and striker with striker. Now Sean was ready for the thrust to the heart, and below them the iron roofs of Fordsburg blinked in the fine, clear sunlight. "Here he comes now," said Mark Anders, and they all lifted their binoculars and searched for the tiny fleck of black in the immense, tall sky. The DH-9 sailed in sedately, banking slowly in from the south and levelling for the run over the cowering cottages of Fordsburg. Through the lenses of his glasses, Mark could make out the head and shoulders of the navigator in the forward cockpit, as he hoisted each stack of pamphlets onto the edge of the cockpit, cut the strings, and then pushed them over the side. They flurried out in a white storm behind the slow-moving machine, caught in the slipstream, spreading and spinning and drifting like flocks of white doves. A push of the breeze spread some of the papers towards the ridge, and Mark caught one out of the air and glanced at the crude printing on cheap, thick paper. It read, "Martial Law. Notice. Women and children and all persons well disposed towards the government are advised to leave before 11 a.m. today, that part of Fordsburg and vicinity where the authority of the government is defied and where military operations are about to take place. No immunity from punishment or arrest is guaranteed to any person coming in under this notice who has broken the law. Sean Courtney, Control Officer." It was clumsy syntax. Mark wondered who had composed it as he crumpled the notice and dropped it into the grass at his feet. "What if the pickets won't let them come out, sir?" he asked quietly. "I don't pay you to be my conscience, young man," Sean growled warningly, and they stood on in silence for a minute. Then Sean sighed and took the cigar from his breast pocket and offered one to Mark as a conciliatory gesture. "What can I do, Mark? Must I send my lads into those streets without artillery support?" He bit the tip off his cigar and spat it into the grass. Whose lives are more important, the strikers and their families, or men who trust me and honour me with their loyalty?
It's much easier to fight people you hate, Mark said softly, and Sean glanced at him sharply.
Where did you read that? He demanded, and Mark shook his head. At least there are no blacks caught up in this, he said. Mark had personally been in charge of sending disguised black policemen through the lines to warn all tribesmen to evacuate the area.
Poor blighters, Sean agreed. I wonder what they make of this white man's madness.
Mark strode to the edge of the shallow cliff, ignoring the danger of sniping fire from the buildings below, and glassed the town carefully. Suddenly he exclaimed with relief,
They're coming out!
Far below where they stood, the first tiny figures straggled out of the entrance of the Frieredorp subway. The women carried infants and dragged reluctant children at arm's length. Some were burdened with their personal treasures, others brought their pets, canaries in wire cages, dogs on leashes. The first small groups and individuals became a trickle, and then a sorry, toiling stream, pushing laden bicycles and hand carts, or simply carrying all the possessions they could lift.
Send a platoon down to guide them and give them a hand, Sean ordered quietly, and brooded heavily with his beard on his chest. I'm glad to see the women out of it, he growled. But I'm sad for what it means.
The men are going to fight, Mark said.
Yes, Sean nodded. They're going to fight. I had hoped we had had enough slaughter, but they're going to make a bitter ending to a tragic tale.
He crushed the stub of his cigar under his heel. You're right, Mark, go down and tell Molyneux that it's on. 1100 hours and we'll open the barrage. Good luck, son. Mark saluted, and Sean Courtney left him and limped back from the crest to join General Smuts and his staff, who had come out to watch the final sweep of the battle. The first shrapnel bursts clanged across the sky and burst in bright gleaming cotton pods of smoke above the roofs of Fordsburg, cracking the sky and the waiting silence with startling violence. They were fired by the horse artillery batteries on the ridge, and immediately the other batteries on Sauer Street joined in. For 20 minutes the din was appalling, and the brilliant air was sullied by the rising mist of smoke and dust. Mark stood in the hastily dug trench and peered over the parapet. There was something so dreadfully familiar in this moment. He had lived it 50 times before, but now he felt his nerves screwing down too tightly, and the heavy, indigestible lump of fear in his guts nauseated him. He wanted to duck down below the parapet, cover his head to protect his ears from the great metallic hammer blows of sound, and stay there. It required an immense effort of will to stand where he was and to keep his expression calm and disinterested. But the men of A Company lined the trench on each side of him, and to distract himself he began to plan his route through the outskirts of the town. There would be roadblocks at every corner, and every cottage would be held. The artillery barrage would not have affected the strikers under cover, for it was limited to shrapnel bursts. Sean Courtney was concerned with the safety of over 100 police and military personnel who had been captured by the strikers and were being held somewhere in the town. No high explosive was the order, and Mark knew his company would be cut to ribbons on the open streets. He was going to take them through the kitchen yards and down the sanitary lanes to their final objective, the trades hall on Commercial and Central Streets. He checked his watch again, and there were 4 minutes to go. All right, Sergeant, he said. The order passed quickly down the trench, and the men came to their feet, crouching below the parapet.
It's like old times, sir, the sergeant said affably, and Mark glanced at him.
He seemed actually to be enjoying this moment, and Mark found himself hating the man for it.
Let's go, he said abruptly,
as the minute hand of his watch touched the black hairline division, and the sergeant blew his whistle shrilly. Mark put one hand on the parapet and leapt nimbly over the top. He started to run forward, and from the cottages ahead of him came the harsh crackling of musketry. Suddenly he realized he was no longer afraid.